Good day. Today is Friday, 22nd May 2026, and may I first begin this programme by expressing my very grateful thanks for all the very kind messages that I have received over the last 24 hours from many of you, both in comments published here on YouTube, but also in private messages connected to my dizziness and ear conditions, which I discussed in a post I published on YouTube yesterday. Let me say briefly as to this, that yes, the last month has been very difficult, but I do believe that as a result of certain medical tests that have taken place over the course of this week, the actual cause of the dizziness has finally been identified, and it is very much in line with what many people have been talking and writing about. And I am confident that with the problem now identified, we will get on the way towards a positive outcome. So I am actually, relieved by the progress in these in the treatment and the way in which this condition is now finally being approached. And I'm also, as I said, extremely grateful and very moved by your messages of support, as indeed has been my wife. Anyway, let me move on now to the rest of the programme. And I'm going to begin this programme by discussing again the topic of energy sanctions and the energy crisis in the West, not just in the West, but specifically in Europe this time. Of course, the energy crisis is global, but it is Europe that I'm going to be mostly talking about. As I discussed recently in a programme, the United States worried about the situation in global oil markets in light of the continued crisis with the Strait of Hormuz, has announced a further 1 month extension of its license to buy oil from Russia, produced from Russia, that is already at sea and which is therefore available on global markets. And Britain, a couple of days ago, in conditions of quite extraordinary recriminations and with much confusion, announced that sanctions were being rolled back to allow the import from the import, not directly from Russia, but through third parties, of certain oil products that originate in Russia, aviation fuel and diesel specifically. By the way, there are reports that the British government has reversed its position again and has decided, following the storm in London, to revert to the previous policy of not accepting these oil products. I've tried to find confirmation of this, and I haven't been able to. And to the best of my knowledge, despite reports that may be appearing in various places, this decision by the British government to roll back on sanctions remains in effect. Well, the European Union, entirely predictably, has taken a completely different line. At the beginning of this year, before the crisis in the Persian Gulf began, the European Union announced that from next year, it would cease all imports of oil and gas products from Russia. And this was not just for the duration of the current crisis in Ukraine. It would be forever. Some European leaders from time to time, these are politicians in member states, still say or still cling to the idea that once the Ukrainian crisis is ended, the Europeans will be able once again to buy oil and gas and other energy products, including coal, by the way, from Russia, as they did before 2022. Well, that may be their hope, but it is not the policy of the European Union. And the European Union has now made clear that it is not prepared to change its approach. It is not prepared to follow the example of the United States and Britain. It will not relax sanctions. And this was made clear by European Commissioner for the Economy, Valdis Dombrovskis. He gave an interview to Euronews and he said that there is no point in going back to Russia. We have diversified our supplies. Our largest gas supplies now come from Norway. Our largest LNG supply is the United States. These are strategic decisions taken to move away completely from Russian oil and gas, and we have to follow through. And he said that the policy would not change, basically, no matter what happens. Now, these are brave words, and they do indicate yet again the level of fervour, I'm going to say it frankly, fanaticism, that there is certainly at the highest levels in the European institutions about Russia. It's not apparently going, the situation as far as they're concerned is not going to change. Whatever happens in Ukraine, if the Russians win, if the Russians lose, if there is a deal done, if there is no deal done, nor apparently is it going to change even if the situation in global energy markets continues to deteriorate. The European Union talks about imports of gas from Norway and imports of LNG from the United States. And certainly, the European Union is now buying a lot of gas from Norway and from the United States. But of course, it comes at a price, much higher price than Russian pipeline gas used to do. And of course, given that the gas from Norway and the gas from the United States is affected by market pricing and conceivably also by geopolitical risks, we'll come to those later, it might be unwise to become completely dependent upon it and to reject the option of pipeline gas or indeed LNG from Russia, which is available or was available in abundant supply and came at a steadier, lower price. But the European Commission, the European leadership, continues to be utterly committed to this approach. And they're basically saying that nothing that happens, however difficult it is, however bad the situation becomes, nothing will ever make them change it. Well, we will see whether that is sustainable. But all I would say is that when playing chess, one should always, it seems to me, play with all 64 squares on the board, refusing under any circumstances, in any situation, to buy energy products from the massive energy producer next door to you who is able to supply or used to be willing to supply your energy in abundant quantities, making your industries competitive and the prices of your goods lower and ensuring a reasonable cost of living across Europe. Well, that all does all seem to me personally extremely strange. But that is the policy. And it is not just in terms of refusal to import energy products from the Russians. We now see a harder line being taken altogether, also by some governments in Europe. So the Prime Minister of Sweden has now said in a press conference with the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, that NATO should take a direct role in guiding Ukrainian drones to their targets inside Russia. Now, that, a point which does not seem to have occurred to the Swedes, essentially means that quite openly, quite straightforwardly, NATO would be involved in conducting strikes, attacks inside Russia. An act of war, by my own understanding, a straightforward act of war. I've always been told that sending an armed man across a border, if one government sends an armed man across a border into another country, that is an act of war. I'm assuming that if a government sets out to send drones intended to conduct strikes inside Russia, that too is an act of war. Now, Sweden is not supposed to be at war with Russia. NATO states, NATO governments repeatedly insist that they are not at war with Russia. They have provided enormous amount of assistance to Ukraine. They've undoubtedly assisted Ukraine in various covert operations against Russia. They have discussed assisting Ukraine to conduct strikes on targets, not just in Russia, but targets that are considered important by the Russians. A couple of years ago, about 2 years ago, there was leaks of transcripts of discussions between German officers about potential attacks on the Crimean Bridge using Taurus missiles, for example, just to say. Something, by the way, which, as it turns out, has never happened. And I've noticed that quietly, without anybody talking about it very much, the Crimean Bridge seems to have stopped being a major focus of Ukrainian and Western interest or of attempted attacks, just to say. But anyway, a lot of that goes on. And of course, it is universally known that Western governments have been helping Ukraine with its drone offensive against Russia. Many of the drones are manufactured in Europe. We've had articles in the US media, in the New York Times, telling us that many of these drones have been guided to their targets by the CIA, that the CIA is deeply implicated and involved in these operations following a series of decisions made by President Trump back in, I think it was April of last year. So all of that has been taking place, but mostly it has been happening in private conversations and private actions. For example, when the Biden administration in 2024 agreed to missile strikes with ATACMS and Storm Shadow missiles against Russia, the Russians correctly pointed out that without direct US involvement, it would not be possible to conduct strikes inside Russia using ATACMS and Storm Shadow missiles. And those attacks did occur, and I don't think anybody who follows the war at all closely and has taken any trouble to familiarise themselves with the technology has any doubt at all that the United States is indeed involved in carrying out these attacks, and the fact has been admitted in the media. But the US government has never formally admitted its direct involvement in these attacks. No European government that I know of has straightforwardly come forward and said that they are participating directly, not just in the war, but in conducting strikes against Russia. And now the Prime Minister of Sweden has come up and suggested quite openly, quite straightforwardly, in the company of the Secretary General of NATO, that NATO start to do that very thing. So an extraordinary escalation, not just in terms of actions, but in terms of rhetoric. The Belarusian authorities have now said that they have information that Lithuania is working alongside Latvia to enable drone strikes on Russia using Lithuanian territory. That's from Belarus. And obviously, I can't corroborate it, but it wouldn't surprise me, I have to say, in the slightest. So, well, we could see more and more of this now taking place. And, well, again, it demonstrates the extremely hard line that some people are taking in Europe. Now, what explains all of this? I'm going to suggest that the real reason all of this is happening is threefold. Firstly, there are increasing doubts about the United States and about the United States' commitment to the war in Ukraine and its commitment to NATO altogether. Apparently, and I think I read this in The Economist, there's been private discussions across Europe that NATO is indeed moving towards its end, that the United States is becoming increasingly detached from NATO and is no longer as committed to NATO as it was, and that the Europeans, before very long, are going to find themselves, in effect, facing off the Russians against the Russians by themselves. Now, the former NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has come out with a statement in which he has said straightforwardly that which deep down I think everybody knows is true, and that is that without the United States, NATO is not viable, and that without the United States, any idea of the European members of NATO taking on the Russians by themselves is a fantasy. So those doubts exist, and they have been reinforced, I am sure, by the growing scepticism, the growing uncertainty about the militarization, the rearmament drive in Europe. The EU foreign policy chief, Kaja Kallas, has complained that an awful lot of money has been spent on rearmament, but doesn't seem to be producing results. There have been similar doubts expressed in Germany as well. Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, has had to convene a meeting of industry chiefs seeking anxious explanations why the increased production of weapons from Europe, from European industry, is not materialising. There's been suggestions that drones are the way forward and that producing drones ought to be simple and straightforward. But actually, it may not be quite as simple or straightforward as people assume, because again, the profit margins on making drones for European industry are very low. And it is not, commercially speaking, perhaps an attractive proposition, unless the price of these drones is increased significantly, which then, of course, defeats the entire purpose. You get another illustration of this by a revelation in Britain that the British military currently has an inventory of around 6,000 drones. This includes kamikaze drones, the kind of drones that the Russians have perfected and the Ukrainians use. Compare that with the fact that the Russians have repeatedly launched drone strikes against Ukraine using around 1,000 Garand drones a day. And the article which I read about the small inventory of drones held by the British military, which was, by the way, in the Daily Telegraph, said that the number of drones would be insufficient in a conflict with the Russians to last a week. Absolutely not, by the way. And, well, there's again talk about ramping up production of drones, but inevitably, you drill through the article, you discover that the cost of doing this has to be increased. The price that these drones must fetch must be increased before industry is prepared to increase production of them. And that is going to be the besetting problem right across European industry. And beyond that, there is the problem of capacity and organisation. European industry is not configured for scaling up weapons production in the way that European leaders and some media commentators imagine. So I think all of this is beginning to hit home and is starting to cause growing nervousness. And by the way, an event that happened over the last 24 hours, I think is going to increase the nervousness even more. In a Truth Social post yesterday, the President of the United States said that after a telephone call with the Polish President, President Nawrocki, he has decided to deploy 5,000 US troops to Poland. And, well, that seems clear enough. And it contradicts, by the way, announcements that had previously been made by the United States that 5,000 European troops, 5,000 American troops will be pulled out of Germany by the end of this year, and that a deployment of 4,000 US troops to Poland, which had previously been agreed, would not happen. So you have what to all appearances is a clear statement of intention by the President of the United States. But by now, everybody knows that what the President writes in a Truth Social post, often after a single conversation and without wider discussion, might not necessarily confirm what happened. And in fact, I have been reading in various places that this announcement on Truth Social has, if anything, deepened the confusion and the dismay. The polls say that they know nothing about this deployment and that nobody from the Pentagon has approached them to talk through this with them. The Europeans are in confusion because of the contradictory signals they are getting from the United States, and they say also that this announcement came to them out of nowhere. And it turns out that in the Pentagon itself, they too were taken by surprise by this announcement. Whether these troops do ever go to Poland, or whether this is another Truth Social post that's now been published and then will be forgotten, is something that I, of course, don't know. I am guessing that it's an announcement that will be forgotten and which will not result in any practical action. But in the meantime, what it does is highlight to the Europeans how volatile and unpredictable American policy has become. It's destabilizing and worrying for them because they don't know from one day to the next what is really happening. And they see announcements like this, which they can't be sure are really true. So that, I think, is one factor that is causing worries in Europe. The reality about the actual military balance in Europe, that despite the talk of rearmament, this is not happening, and the military balance continues to shift in Russian favour, that the American commitment is not as strong as it was and doesn't seem to be as strong as it used to be towards Ukraine as well. So that's one factor. The second is the broader economic factor, which is causing a deepening crisis in Europe and which is what underpins this decision by the European Commission to come out with this announcement that under no circumstances will Europe reverse its decision and begin or resume importing Russian oil and Russian gas. The Europeans are perfectly well aware that there is a looming crisis in the energy markets. I've been reading in the Financial Times that June is the month when the buffers created through the build-up of oil reserves begin to run out. And from that moment, we could start to see actual oil shortages, fuel shortages, spread to Europe as well. And we could start to see increases in prices. And inevitably, at a time when much of the European Union is already under great economic stress, Germany has been either stagnating or in recession continuously since 2022, with the start of the special military operation, and arguably going back further still, right through the period of the pandemic, you could argue that the last normal year for the German economy was 2019. Just saying. Well, this coming energy shock at a time when European governments and European countries altogether are deeply indebted is inevitably going to have an impact. And it's having already a political impact in Germany, where there are now clear signs of a fracturing of Friedrich Merz's coalition. And of course, all of that also calls into question the entire idea of rearmament of Europe going by itself, taking on Russia without the United States, and all these things. To say it straightforwardly, if there is a period of recession and crisis in the European economy at the end of this year and the beginning of next year, then I think there will be little patience on the part of European publics to money being thrown at a European arms industry which devours money but produces no weapons. Just as so. So that, I think, is a further factor that causes concern. It may also be the case, by the way, that some European leaders, and some American leaders too, might understand that America's own position in terms of energy is brittle. Now, I was informed about all of this about a week ago by the US attorney, Robert Barnes, who's pointed out that, in fact, the idea of US energy independence or self-sufficiency is something of an illusion. Well, there's now been an article in the Financial Times which says the same thing. The fragile maths of Uncle Sam's energy self-sufficiency. And, well, it says essentially the very same things that Robert Barnes told me privately in an email. The United States is only a net exporter because its fields produce a lot of natural gas, liquids, stuff such as ethane and propane, which it largely ships abroad and which are included on a barrel equivalent basis in official numbers. These are valuable as petrochemical feedstocks and are blended into fuels, but they cannot be used to produce petrol, diesel, or jet fuel. Stripping them out, the US surplus disappears. The US is actually a net importer of crude oil to the tune of more than 2 million barrels a day in 2025. In practice, it has to import about three times that because its refineries are ill-suited to the light sweet oil its fields produce. The Energy Information Administration reckons last year that the United States brought in more than 6 million barrels a day of heavy oil, in large part from Canada, and exported 4 million of its own. So American self-sufficiency is something of a mirage. It does exist, but more as a mathematical construct than as a fact. The United States must import heavy crude because its refineries are structured to refine heavy crude rather than light crude, which is what American fields produce. And though it imports light crude, when you take out other liquid products like ethane and propane, overall, the United States is an importer, not an exporter of oil, and does not have the self-sufficiency that many imagine. Now, the Financial Times article asserts that this means that the United States, in the event of an energy shock, the energy shock reaching the United States by the autumn of this year, is less likely to import and export to impose an export ban on oil, such as it had up to 2015. I beg to differ. I think that the Trump administration, Donald Trump himself personally, are going to be less interested in the fine points of light crude and heavy crude and those sort of things. If they sense that energy prices, prices at the gas stations are indeed increasing, they're going to do everything they possibly can to husband supplies of oil in the United States, which it is clear are not as extensive as people suppose, and that makes them more, not less, likely to resist pressure for an export ban. And, well, going back to the situation with the Europeans, all of that is going to throw them, catapult them into an even greater crisis in the autumn and winter, if that is indeed what takes place. So that is another factor, I think, that is causing worry and alarm in Europe. But then there is a third factor as well, and that is what is actually going on in the war in Ukraine. And there's a number of things to say here. We've had a sustained narrative which has been going on for about, I guess, about 3 months now, that the war is in stalemate, that the Ukrainians have gained overall the advantage, that the Russian economy is in increasing stress, that Vladimir Putin's political position in Russia is deteriorating, that the drone strikes by Ukraine on Russia are weakening Russia and are weakening Putin, and that really all that needs to be done is to hold out just a little longer and everything will come together at last. The long expected, long hoped for internal crisis in Russia will hit, and then at that moment, finally, at long last, the Europeans will have achieved their objectives with Russia. Well, I'm going to say that no part of that is true, and I'm going to start briefly by discussing the economy. Now, we've had a lot of information about the situation in the economy over the last few weeks, and we can start with a set of figures about the state of the economy that was provided by Putin on the 15th of May at a government meeting in Moscow. Putin claimed that wholesale trade grew by 8% in March, retail trade increased by 6.2% in March, unemployment remained at 2.2% in March, industrial output in March rose by 2.3%, manufacturing output grew by 3% overall. Now, if all those figures are correct, then I'm going to suggest that the number that we've seen quoted for the economic rebound in Russia in March, a 1.8% rise in GDP, is almost certainly an underestimate. It seems to me likely that GDP grew much faster than that, and we're looking at a number well above 2%, perhaps, well, some points above 2%. And I noticed, incidentally, that the European Commission has now upgraded its forecast for the growth of the Russian economy this year. It says that economic growth this year will be around 1.3% in Russia in GDP terms. And if the rebound continues as strong as it was in March, that might be an underestimate. We've also had information about inflation. Over the last 4 weeks, Russia has experienced 2 weeks of deflation, of actually falling prices, and the week that has just passed was one of these. The overall rate of inflation at an annualized rate in Russia is around 5.4%, which is starting to take us closer and faster towards the central bank's 4% target. Apparently, there has been an increase in tax revenue as well, which is what you would expect when the economy returns to growth, as it did in March. And in April, the government also started to receive, the budget started to receive further receipts from the recent rise in oil prices. And, well, I'm going to say it, I think we're going to see growth well above most estimates in Russia this year, and probably inflation lower. The stresses in the Russian economy that many people have been talking about were a feature, though an exaggerated feature, of 2025, of last year. They're going to fade this year, especially as the fall of inflation causes Russian interest rates to fall. Well, to what extent European leaders know about this, I don't know. But perhaps they ought to be informed about it. And if they look at these numbers carefully, then they will have noticed something else. There's been no effect from the Ukrainian drone attacks on overall Russian oil exports. There's been no effect from the Ukrainian attacks on the overall performance of the Russian economy. As was pointed out recently by the Russian Economics Ministry in a report to Putin, real incomes in Russia are still rising. The number of people directly affected by drone strikes, by Ukrainian drone strikes, over the vast territory of Russia continues to be extremely small. The drone offensive is not having the effects that many people in the West believe. It is not causing stresses in the economy, which are abating. It's not causing stresses in the budget, which are abating. It is not causing living standards to fall. They are rising. And it is not disrupting to any significant degree the actual performance of the economy, which continues to remain stable and which will probably move into more sustained growth later this year. So that's the overall picture in the economy and with the Ukrainian drone offensive, despite all of the rhetoric and all of the demands that we see from people, hardline people in the West and in Europe specifically. And then, of course, we now turn to the military situation. And here again, we're starting to see more effects from the Russian offensive, which began last month and which continues to gain momentum. Now, over the last 24 hours, the Russian Defense Ministry has confirmed a report published by the Russian newspaper Radovka that the important fortified village of Verkhnoye Terse in Zaporozhye region has indeed been published, has indeed been captured by the Russians. And there's no doubt at all about this. The Russians have published extensive film from this particular village. There are lots of pictures of Russian soldiers on the territory of the village raising Russian flags. There's no doubt that the Russians are in control of Verkhnoye Terse. The Rydovka also claimed 2 days ago that the Russians have also captured another village in this area called Vosvizhevka, which is located, by my understanding, a little to the north of Verkhnoye Terse. And there's apparently been video footage which shows Ukrainian drone strikes on Russian troops inside a third village, again in this general area called Gulyapolske. Now, these three villages, Verkhnoye Terse, Vosvizhevka, and Gulyapolske, made up the last significant fortified line. In fact, I believe it's not the last significant, it is the last fortified line that the Ukrainians still retained east of the town of Orekhov in Zaporozhye region. If all of these places are falling, or have fallen, as Rydovka says, and as the Russian Defense Ministry somewhat implies, then once the Russians have fully cleared these villages and consolidated and have established secure river crossings across the Gaichur River, which is somewhat to the east, pontoon bridges and that kind of thing, well, then the Russians have an open route towards Orekhov itself and can begin to attack Orekhov from the east and the north. Now, Rydovka yesterday had a very interesting and rather complex discussion about the situation in Zaporozhye region. It said that the major threat to Orekhov has always come from the east, that the fall of the town of Gulyapolye in east of Orekhov at the end of last year caused an atmosphere of crisis in the Ukrainian command, that Sirsky and Zelensky and the Ukrainian general staff rushed whatever available troops they had to try to stabilize the situation in Zaporozhye region before Orekhov fell, that they launched their counterattack first in eastern Zaporozhye to try to stop this advance by the Russians towards Orekhov. That counteroffensive ultimately failed. When it failed, the Ukrainians launched another counteroffensive along the Dnieper River in western Zaporozhye, trying to reach the town of Stepnogorsk, which the Russians captured towards the end of last year. That in order to conduct that offensive, the Ukrainians, who are very short of manpower, were obliged to transfer some of their forces from the eastern Zaporozhye front, that nonetheless they were not able to break through in western Zaporozhye, but that the result was that the eastern front, the front east of Orekhov, was weakened, and that it is this which has now enabled the Russians so decisively to break through? Well, I am not going to get into a discussion about whether or not all of this is correct. It's interesting, and it does show that tactical decisions probably are still made by commanders. I remember that way back in 2022, I was struck by the very virtuosic way in which the Russian general, General Teplinsky, who was defending Kherson region west of the Dnieper, was moving around his forces. And Teplinsky is the senior general in this area around Orekhov and Zaporozhye City. And I can imagine that he might be able to carry out an operation as complex as the one that Radovka describes. I would say that two different groups of forces are involved, Russian group of forces are involved. And if it is Teplinsky's doing, then the commander of one of these group of forces has to be willing to accept Teplinsky's orders, which perhaps is the case. I simply don't know. But anyway, putting aside, I'm not necessarily going to explore myself the military tactics involved. The important and key thing is that the Russians now have an open route towards Orekhov. And, well, apparently there aren't many defences around Orekhov, protecting Orekhov from an attack from the east. The Russians will be behind Orekhov, north of Orekhov, fairly soon. What the Ukrainians can do with whatever forces they still have in the area, I don't know. Radovka and others like Scott at Calibrated have spoken of the Ukrainians suffering heavy losses as a result of these counterattacks intended to stabilize the situation in Zaporozhye. All I will say is this: it does seem to me that the days of Orekhov are now counted. I can't see how this town can be defended for very long. I suspect that we're going to see a collapse there of the same sort that we saw in Ugledar in 2024 and in Siversk in 2025. And of course, if Orekhov falls and falls suddenly, as those two other towns did, well, that does indeed open the way to the city of Zaporozhye itself. And, well, that would be a major crisis for Ukraine, and it could come as soon as the autumn. Just saying. So, there is this crisis in Zaporozhye, and then there is the other crisis in Konstantinovka, which is, of course, a crisis in Donbass. Now, here, again, Radovka provided an incredibly detailed picture in an article about 2 days ago about the state of the fighting. I'm not going to repeat it. It essentially said the same things that I have been discussing previously about Ukrainian troops encircled in the south of Konstantinovka, about Ukrainian troops being encircled east of Konstantinovka, of the supply roads routes into Konstantinovka now being heavily controlled by Russian drones, of the Russians penetrating into the central areas of the town, of the whole of Konstantinovka, west of the river that bisects the town, being about to fall. And interestingly, we've had some corroboration of some of this from CNN. A CNN team apparently went to the town of Druzhivka, which is located just to the north of Konstantinovka. They tried to inspect, if you will, the main supply road leading from Druzhivka into Konstantinovka. They found the sky full of Russian drones. They saw that Ukrainian troops trying to reinforce Konstantinovka itself basically had to move on foot in order to dodge the drones. It doesn't seem as if many supplies are going to be able to get through. There's talk about another road of death having been created by the Russians between Druzhivka and Konstantinovka, very much like what we saw in Pokrovsk a few months ago and in other places. And well, as I've said already, I think that the Battle of Konstantinovka is the biggest that's been fought at the present time and the one which is perhaps up to now the most important. Anyway, so we have all of this information. There's been more information about a Russian build-up in northeastern Ukraine, in Kharkov, Chernigov and Sumy regions. General Gerasimov recently told us that the Russians control 85% of Liman, close to Slavyansk itself. If you look at a map, you could see that the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation has already been taken by the Russians into a semicircle. It is the last remaining place in Donbass, still under Ukrainian control. And it looks as if Ukrainian control of this area too is perhaps now to be counted more in months than years, as some people still optimistically want to believe. Well, again, one does wonder how much of this is understood by some European officials. I do get the impression from time to time that European officials themselves are willfully deceiving themselves about Ukrainian realities, particularly Ukrainian realities on the front lines. But certain comments that the Europeans are saying would be consistent with a sudden awareness that far from things being stable on the front lines, they're actually now deteriorating. And, well, we got a further illustration of this when one European leader, I believe it was Donald Tusk, actually said that it might not be possible for much longer to keep the situation in the war in Ukraine confined to Ukraine itself, that the situation in Ukraine was escalating, that before long, difficult decisions might have to be made in order to prevent the situation in Ukraine from getting worse. Now, he wasn't completely clear about what he meant, but I do wonder whether he was again suggesting that some sort of direct Western or NATO involvement in the war will soon have to be considered because the situation in Ukraine is deteriorating so fast. And, well, if that is the case, then you can understand these latest statements of the Swedish Prime Minister, the European Commissioner for Economy and others. They are trying to firm up the European hard line because they know that the situation is getting worse and will soon get much worse, and that they've been worried by the rhetoric, the observations made by some people in Europe that the moment might have come actually to start talking to the Russians, and they worry that before long, with things deteriorating, the pressure to do that and perhaps to change policy on sanctions might become too strong, and they want to preempt it. Well, there it is. That's what I imagine. Now, on the Russian side, there's been a number of very interesting commentaries about the situation in Ukraine. There's been a long piece by the vice chairman of Russia's Security Council, who is, as I've said already, the effective head of Russia's Military Industrial Commission. I mean, of course, Dmitry Medvedev, who used to be Russia's president and prime minister. And he's written a lengthy piece about how Ukraine is now, in effect, a failed state. He says that it has no longer has a functioning economy. Economic activity in Ukraine now entirely depends on foreign funding. There is a demographic collapse. The situation with the military is poor. And he spoke about a Ukrainian government that no longer performs most of the conventional functions of government, but is basically there to preserve Zelensky's power and to keep the war going. Well, that was Medvedev. There was another article published on surprisingly similar lines by a Russian military commentator, whom I mentioned before, called Sergei Poletayev. Maybe he was taking his cue from Medvedev, but he too spoke about Ukraine being, in effect, a hollowed out state. There's still an army which is still fighting, though its ability to go on doing so for much longer is increasingly in doubt. The economy has collapsed, the population has fallen, the government isn't functioning properly, the situation is no longer that of a normal country. And again, a little bit like Medvedev said, there is now a massive gap which has appeared between the government and wider Ukrainian society, which finds itself under almost unbearable pressure. Now, that's Sergei Poletayev. Now, there may be some exaggeration in some of this. I mean, I do get the sense that in most of Ukraine, some of the normal processes of government still pertain. I mean, taxes are still collected, there's still administration, rubbish, I suppose, is collected, that kind of thing. It's not true that Ukraine as an administrative state no longer works anymore. But certainly there have been problems in the economy. Even despite Western aid, the economy, according to official statistics, the Ukrainian economy, according to official statistics, actually contracted in the first 3 months of the year. Normally, because of the amount of Western aid, the contractions in Ukrainian economic activity are disguised. In fact, you even get periods when Ukrainian GDP appears to grow, something which then causes enormous amount of excitement and jubilation among some Western commentators who don't realize that the reason why GDP rates in the past have grown in Ukraine over the course of the war is largely because of the enormous influx of their own tax dollars, just to say. But, well, it's true that some of the flow of money into Ukraine did decline in the first 3 months of this year. But my own sense is that what also happened in the first 3 months of this year is that perhaps in part as a product of the massive Russian missile and drone strikes and the destruction of much of the energy complex, the fall in economic activity was just too great for infusions of money from the West to mask. And one thing does indeed still seem to be happening, which is that we continue to see inflation numbers in Ukraine rise, even as inflation in Russia falls. Inflation in Ukraine has been rising and is now officially in double figures, though I still myself feel that these inflation figures are almost certainly heavily distorted as well. The Ukrainian currency also appears to be on the slide. Now, because of Russian oil exports, rebound in oil exports and export revenue, because Russian food products are now in heavy supply, because Russia is once again running a very big current account surplus, because the budget in Russia is closing, the deficit in the budget is closing, because interest rates in Russia remain so high at a level of around 10% in real interest rates. The ruble continues to strengthen. It's now at about $70, 70 rubles to the dollar, which, by the way, Russian exporters complain is much too strong, and which they and the economics ministry would want to see reduced because it weakens competitiveness. But anyway, that is another story. The higher exchange rate, the strong exchange rate in Russia, is having one effect, which is that it is reducing inflation and might be part of the reason why we have seen instances of deflation in Russia over the last weeks. In Ukraine, it is the opposite story. The Ukrainian currency, the hryvnia, has been weakening. And I saw a report that put it 44 to the dollar, which does suggest a significant deterioration over the last few years, just to say. And apparently now it is at its lowest level ever to the dollar. Now, Ukraine is not an exporting economy. The Russians have, in effect, imposed an effective sea blockade of Odessa. Ukraine imports consumer goods, money, and, of course, it also imports weapons and the technology to make weapons and all of those things. So Ukraine is running a deficit on its current account. Its GDP, its debt to GDP ratio is above 100% and continues to deteriorate. Well, you can see that there is truth in what Politaev and Medvedev are saying, at least some truth, in the sense of how this applies to the economy. And though there is massive disagreement about the numbers, there is general consensus that population in Ukraine has sharply fallen over the course of the war. Medvedev, by the way, says that it might be as low as 18 million people, though he doesn't provide any evidence at all to support that claim. Anyway, the most interesting fact about Politaev's analysis is that he nonetheless discounts any idea that Ukraine might negotiate peace. He considers, or appears to consider, that the likeliest outcome is indeed a collapse both on the fronts and across the entire territory of Ukraine, of a collapse of a political and administrative structure that has become dysfunctional and hollowed out. But beyond that, he imagines continued resistance. And he speaks of this resistance continuing to be carried out by the various far-right militias, organizing themselves in various insurgent groups, some of them no doubt based in Europe, though he doesn't talk about that. He says that even in the event of a collapse, there would continue to be drone strikes against Russia, and that Russians need to be prepared for that reality. Medvedev and Politaev, and I understand other Russian commentators who I have not read, what they seem to be doing is preparing the Russian public for a situation on a bigger scale, but in other respects very like what happened in Chechnya, where the conventional military war was won after about 10 years of fighting, by the way, but was then followed by a further decade of pacification, of countering insurgent groups and people hiding in mountains and forests and that kind of thing, and trying to continue resistance that way, before the situation in Ukraine was fully stabilized. And well, I think this has very disturbing implications for the future. If this is correct, it does perhaps give us some idea of Russian timelines. Even if Kiev falls and Odessa is captured or liberated, as some say, and the Russians gain control of all the territories on the east bank of the Dnieper and perhaps move beyond the Dnieper and take possession of whatever's left, even then, there would still be a long period of instability and violence before the situation, from a Russian point of view, is fully stabilized. It's in some ways a bleak picture, I think in the absence of a diplomatic resolution, of which, to be clear, I see no sign, and which Politaev discounts, I think it might be an accurate one. And whilst the Russians obviously are going to have a lot of work to do in this pacifying mission that Politaev was talking about, well, it's not as if they don't have experience in this kind of thing. On that, by the way, and maybe it is not coincidence, Radovka was also talking about the pacification programs that the Soviet authorities had to carry out in Ukraine and the Baltic states after the Second World War, which also seemed to point, by the way, in the same direction. There's been a cluster of articles about that appearing there. Well, all I will say is, if that is indeed what happens, then it is terrible news for Europe, because even that kind of submerged conflict is inevitably going to be extremely destabilizing for Europe altogether. Well, there it is. We seem to be in Europe determined to make our situation worse all the time. I have no simple words to describe what we do. Maybe we are indeed moving towards some kind of major crisis in Europe, out of which something better eventually will come. But frankly, if we want to create that crisis and inflict it upon ourselves, then it seems to me that we're going about it in exactly the right way. Now, here I'm going to also turn quickly to the situation in the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, and between the United States and Iran. There's been a cascade of reports in the US media which are pointing and highlighting the full extent of the military debacle that that the United States suffered in Iran. It seems that the Iranians managed to hit quite a lot of US aircraft, and did indeed manage to bring some of the aircraft that they claimed down. It seems that the Iranians do have means to track F-35 stealth fighters, and there are reports that they've obtained technology to enable them to do that from the Russians, reports which, by the way, I think are entirely believable. There are reports that they have reconstructed their military industrial base, restored their launch sites, dispersed their launchers across their territory, and strengthened their air defences. There are further reports that the US military, low on stockpiles and busy, by the way, leaking that fact to the American media, all of the reports about rundown stockpiles that you see appearing across the US media clearly have their source from within the United States government. The military and the Pentagon are clearly anxious that the message that the stockpiles have been run down be put across, so that the political class and the American people more widely understand why a further renewed attack on Iran is not a wise option. Anyway, we have all of this going on. We see the Strait of Hormuz continue to be closed. We see this bizarre pseudo-negotiation take place where the Iranians send ideas to the Pakistanis, the Americans send idea in writing to the Pakistanis, the Pakistanis then exchange these documents. Donald Trump falls into a rage when he sees what the Iranians are wanting. We have all sorts of talk about letters of agreement being worked on and making progress, and that is then immediately contradicted. What we're not seeing at the moment is any negotiations. And there's no sign at the moment that any serious negotiations are taking place. Each side is waiting out the other. The Iranians believe that the energy crisis will force the Americans eventually to come to terms. And they're feeling apparently increasingly confident on the military side. And Donald Trump and his officials, wrongly in my opinion, imagine that their sea blockade of Iran eventually in some form is going to force the Iranians to capitulate, which I think is a case of hope triumphing over experience. I don't believe that that will happen. But what I want to talk about briefly is this fantastic story that came out 2 days ago in the New York Times, that when the United States and Israel launched their attack on Iran, they actually had a substitute leader in place who would take over, who was none other than the former president, Ahmadinejad. Well, this is interesting because, of course, at the time, most of the talk was that the leader that the Israelis had in mind was the son of the late Shah of Iran. He supposedly was the person who was going to actually go to Iran and take over once the regime collapsed within the first week from the various blows that the Americans and the Israelis were launching. Well, it turns out that in fact it looks as if it was somebody even more unlikely, and that is Ahmadinejad, a deeply unpopular figure in Iran itself at the present time, someone who is isolated in the political system and really has no ability, in my opinion, to lead Iran, and who is an individual of such extraordinary vanity that I would have thought anyway he would be an impossible person to control. To my mind, what this revelation, which I notice has not been convincingly disputed, what this revelation reveals is the unbelievable amateurism and chaotic nature of the preparations that were made before the war. What makes this even more revealing is that the Ahmadinejad idea, as well as the entire regime change idea, and the whole policies based around it, appear to have originated with Mossad, Israel's famous intelligence agency. The only conclusion I can draw from this is that Mossad is not quite as successful and effective as an intelligence agency as many people believe. I suspect, as Ray McGovern often says about the CIA, that Mossad long ago gave so much of its time and attention to what are politely referred to as covert operations, murders, assassinations, kidnappings, that kind of thing, that they lost sight of the primary function of an intelligence agency, which is to gather and analyse intelligence. And clearly, they lost sight of the actual realities inside Iran, which, in that case, begs the question of why does the President of the United States and his team continue to spend so much time listening to what the Prime Minister of Israel and the Prime Minister's Israeli intelligence officials are saying about Iran, when it has turned out to be so hopelessly, so completely, so catastrophically wrong? Well, I'm sure there's lots of people who can come up with all sorts of ideas about that. But I think the question does need to be asked. We hear all the time about telephone conversations between Netanyahu and Trump. Supposedly, according to Axios, they had a very fraught one a few days ago. I don't place much value on that story, by the way, just to say. My question is, why does the president spend so much time talking to Netanyahu at all? Anyway, there it is. That's what I'm going to say today in this program about the situation. Thank you again, all of you, for your kind words about my health and my dizziness and my ear conditions and all of those things. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.